Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Good morning, Teresa. Good morning, Di. I am delighted to have you both on the Fundraising Talent Podcast this morning. I apologize for being late. Nobody set my alarm clock, but I've got my coffee in hand. I'm looking forward to this conversation. Di, you're our guest this morning, so how about we ask you to introduce yourself, and then we'll have you give us your bold idea or bold opinion. Teresa is my co-host. We'll have you introduce yourself after Di. Di, tell us who you are.
I'm Di Boyer, live in Lexington, Kentucky, and I am the director of giving for LexArts, which is for Lexington is our local arts council, and we operate the Fund for the Arts, 49th year in Lexington, providing the fundraising and just overall support for the arts. It's a happy job.
Di, I think you're the first guest that I've had on here, probably in the sort of the, we've probably broadcast 50, 60, We did have a large arts group from Toronto on here last summer, but I haven't as of late talked to someone in the art space, sort of in the midst of sort of the COVID sort of conversation. What's it like?
Well, I can tell you, 2020, this is what we woke up January 1st, 2020. Our executive director, who had been there, beloved, announces early retirement, moving back to Michigan. So, you know, that's how we started the year.
Yeah.
Small team. My colleague, the director of development for the arts organization, is diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Then in March, I mean, it just was like boom, boom, boom. And boom, she subsequently passed away on April the 10th. So the start of our quarter last year, I mean, I almost considered retirement. This was pre-COVID, like, you know, and I remember making a post, and it was on my Instagram, of the reset button saying 2020, like, I need to hit reset. Like, right. You're not starting off really great.
Right.
And so we had the most beautiful Fund for the Arts campaign plan, probably our most organized one we've ever had. Great theme, great collaterals, great leadership, everything. We kicked off the campaign on March the 10th in Lexington with the mayor, with, you know, all the dignitaries. And virtually, it was the last time we saw the mayor, you know, like the city shut down like 3 days later.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm an OG. I've been fundraising like 35 years, 40 years. And never in my life was I prepared, you know, it was going to be bad, but we didn't know how bad. So yeah. I can remember the first time, you know, setting up a Zoom call. I'd never even heard of Zoom. You know, it was just such an eye-opening experience for our team, but really for the whole city. So that's how our 2020 started.
Yes, yes. And Teresa, if you recall, I know you recall, Teresa, you and I had a conversation right at the beginning of sort of the when COVID-19 sort of became our reality. And you and I, as well as a series of guests, talked about sort of how do we navigate the sort of fear. And that conversation, Teresa, continues to be for the last 12 months the most popular downloaded conversation that we've got on the podcast. So I'm delighted to have you back. You haven't co-hosted with me in a while. Teresa, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners and then tell me what you think about sort of having that sort of that hot spot there on the list.
Oh, wow. My name is Teresa Lee, and I am a fundraising consultant in Massachusetts, in central Massachusetts. Prior to that, I had a 25-year career in higher education around the Boston and Worcester area.
Yep.
15 of those were at MIT, my beloved MIT. And I consult with small nonprofits in the area, Boston, all the way out to Central Mass. And I love what I do. The other thing that I do is I teach fundraising through Boston University. There's an online fundraising program, a certificate program, and you can earn your CFRE points as well. And it's 12 weeks and I teach 3 or 4 weeks depending, and it's always been online. So I've only ever taught online. So all the people that made that shift to online, as I watched them struggle, I thought, well, what's the big deal? But
right. You knew how to do it.
I had a head start. Yeah. And in terms of that podcast, Jason, that was from the heart. I remember at that moment in time, you know, the world was kind of, pressing down on everybody. And obviously it's gotten much worse. But what I remember thinking is, even in bad times, and Di, you have been through bad times before, you know, 9/11, economic downturns, you've been around longer than I've been around. And what happens is that creativity springs from hard times. I've seen that in my career so many times. In fact, I had a colleague at MIT who said, I kind of like it when they cut our budget because it makes us more creative. And so I thought, you know, beauty and creativity and humanity often spring out of times when we are at our seemingly lowest moments. So I think that's what we were talking about during that podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Teresa, I think that it was an extraordinary conversation, and it was a great series. And I think it really, one of the fortunate benefits, as perhaps the two of you are, you could kind of quickly figure out, podcasting just allows you to create meaningful content really quickly. And so I think part of what a lot of people appreciated, and I had some folks from Canada reach out to me shortly after that particular series broadcast, and they said, man, you were able to put out some meaningful, thoughtful content really quickly. And it's just because the format and what you're doing and the production is actually very quick, and you can do it relatively easily. Di, we invite our guest, the individual in your seat, to bring a bold opinion, a big idea. We don't always even ask what that is, so this could totally throw me off my rocker. I have yet to have anyone throw me off on a big idea or bold opinion. You have been around a while, as have Teresa and I, so we know the fundraising space, but what do you have for us today?
So let me just frame it up just a little bit. So going back to March the 10th, we decided to dig our heels in even more so, with more passion than ever for this campaign, because what LexArts does, we do the fundraising, but then we re-grant it out to about 40 to 50 smaller arts organizations. So I lay my head on the pillow each night going, you know, all these groups are depending on me because they don't have a die. You know, these are small, wonderful, diverse, you know, just amazing things adding to the fiber of Lexington that are counting on us. So yeah. One of the things the campaign, obviously corporate donors, individual donors, but we also do a pretty robust workplace giving campaign. Well, nobody's at work. So converting all of our collaterals, you know, to something emailable and, you know, getting people to jump on Zoom and making it fun and having conversations. And so that was one of the things that we started asking the question, like, what's your why? What was your arts experience? So all of a sudden I'm talking with CEOs and CFOs and different folks. Yeah, I was in the band. Yeah, I was in the school play. Yeah, you know, I love music. I've been to umpteen concerts. We got people talking about what the arts meant, you know, in their heart. And so, Teresa, you had said something. We believe that there will be no recovery for any group without creativity. So that was kind of taped across our screens, our boards. And even in the workplace, I mean, we had to think more creatively than we ever have in our life. So the mailers had already been mailed. So people left, you know, the kickoff, then the city closes down, but they open their mailbox and there's this beautiful, and I would invite viewers to go on to the LexArts.org and take a peek because the videos, everything's posted there. But it was a boomerang theme. Our whole theme for the campaign was a boomerang, which I've never seen anything like it. So the idea with the boomerang, when you launch it, it should come back to you.
Yes,
and we believe when you invest in the arts and you invest in something that you're really passionate about, the good is going to come back, and it's going to come back in a myriad of ways. So that was my, you know, my elevator pitch to all these companies. Well, lo and behold, guess what happened? People still started sending in money. They still went to the website. They started clicking. Yeah. They started giving. But we're a staff of six people. So it was like retrain really fast. Everybody's going to be part of the thank you, the stewardship committee. Everybody who makes a gift, no matter if it's $5 or $10 or $1,000 or $50,000, they're getting a personal call. Not an email, not a text, but a call. And they were like, oh, die. People don't answer their phone if they don't know the number. They're not going to pick up your cell phone number. Well, I beg to differ with you.
Right.
They did. And people were absolutely amazed that we took the time to make these phone calls, which is kind of an old school going back.
Yeah.
That we started seeing people saying, you're the only group. You're the only organization that we give to that has ever done something like this. So this leads me to my next big, bold, bodacious idea. And it's actually going to be happening because we're doing the relaunch of the boomerang again in about 2 weeks. But this time, they're not getting just one response vehicle, one envelope. They're getting two. They're getting two. So they're getting an envelope with a boomerang and a second one for a half a boomerang. And that is making a gift in honor of that art teacher or that physician that took care of their dad or the music, or it's almost like a ticket to a concert that they couldn't go to. They're paying it forward. So what we saw people giving multiple times last year. Even though the city paused the funding for almost all the organizations that they normally fund, we had a very robust fundraising year.
Yeah. I mean, have we all been around long enough to sort of know, you know, if we were in the private sector and let's say we worked for a finance firm or something, we'd all sort of have a sense of how the economy works and the stock market works. And we'd sort of see and know those indicators. But when it comes to the nonprofit sector, you know, we've been around long enough to know that arts organizations typically sometimes struggle the most from times like this. But is to going back to some of the comments you made at the very beginning of your remarks, Di, is are the arts organizations sort of quote unquote coming back, sort of that strongest indicator that the sector has now recovered from whatever sort of punch in the gut it has recently experienced, you know? I don't think I've ever written that down. I don't know that I've ever thought that way, but you know, the arts organizations are presumably those places where, you know, they oftentimes suffer from support, but they also are those places. Sometimes those are the places that we love the most, and we can't ultimately, if they suffer in great, you know, with the great magnitude, we're not, even if they go away, we're going to want them to come back.
Yes.
Right.
I mean, traditionally arts, like, you know, we all survived the bad times, you know, in the past with the economic downturns, but I'm not kidding you. In Lexington, we have this beautiful historic theater, and you know, all they wanted to do was fill it with folks. You know, they missed the concerts, they missed the ballet, we missed the Nutcracker. Well, we had a virtual Nutcracker.
Yeah.
But if you drive down Main Street in Lexington right now on the marquee, the sign says this is only intermission. Like the second act is going to be really, really good in 2021, and we're expecting that. But they set up, here's a creative idea. They set up a miniature golf course in the theater, and it's all arts themed. So you can go social distance. You can bring your family, get out of the house and go, like, it's just like a little putt-putt, you know, golf around the stage, down the aisles. People are having a ball because it's, you know, it's a way to get them back in the theater, make a little money and do it safely. We have seen it over and over and over again. I think the biggest failure last year for groups is the ones that just hunkered down and closed their doors. The ones that, you know, said, oh, we can't have events, we can't do this, we can't do this. They're going to have the hardest time recovering. I think because we dug our heels in and worked harder, people are understanding, my gosh, you brought such joy last year. We put together a teacher's guide. So all the teachers that were, you know, at home trying to now come up with a non-traditional format, what if we put all the things that are arts related into a really easy grouping, you know, that you can click and say, oh yeah, this is appropriate. You know, you can watch this for free. You can stream it. Teachers don't have time to research all those things. So I just feel like, beyond fundraising, we brought joy, or we kept the joy coming when people need it the most.
Yeah, I mean,
now
it strikes
boomerang's coming. It's coming back. The boomerang is still coming back.
It strikes me that organizations that believed in their relevance before the pandemic persisted. Right, you have to really understand your place in your community, and it sounds like you've always done a good job of creating good, strong relationships so that, and think about this neighbor to neighbor, when hard times come, if you have a good neighborhood and you have good friends, they rise to the occasion to help one another. If it affects us all, we all are linking together in any way, shape or form that we can. And you're the conduit to that.
And as a major gifts person, I've been in major gifts usually really my whole career. Is that I was never an events kind of girl. I never believed that, you know, your one big gala is going to, you know, be what people remember. People didn't miss those things. They didn't miss the galas, but they missed the concerts, and they missed the, you know, the having the artists painting on the streets. And we ended up doing a lot of live air painting, which, you can still be outside with a mask, and people loved it. It was still a way for us to put our galleries online, sell art. We did something, I would say, pretty cool every single month.
And people were looking for outlets, right, for joy and inspiration and things to do with their children or their families. And art is such a great outlet.
Put that on my LinkedIn. I think that was one of the things. So we had an artist paint. He said, joy is never canceled. Art is never canceled. You know, like yeah, this is not easy, but it's not canceled. Yeah.
I have told our clients for years. So I've worked in the private and independent school space for a long time, and they just like private schools don't have to be private schools. Schools in general have their own calendar of events that are directly tied to the students that they're serving. They have everything from talent shows, and they honor students and they honor teachers. They've got a whole calendar of, you know, events. And just like the arts community, they have a whole calendar of events. They got shows that they want to, you know, there's a whole, and I've always said to these particular types of clients, why do we invent these sort of these additional quote unquote events to raise money, when in fact, if you just sort of piggyback, if you were strategic and you were creative, you could just sort of piggyback and engage your donors in those events. And it's interesting to sort of listen to what you're saying, Di. And Teresa, I'm interested to hear your thoughts as a teacher, because you're teaching this stuff in a classroom, and it would seem like COVID-19 would sort of, in some ways, sort of change the way that we might sort of, teach what it means to put on special events in the context of fundraising. Because I have always thought, why are we putting on a gala and a golf tournament when you've got that great community-wide event that, if you knew how to engage your donors into that existing event, which your donors want to come to just like everybody else in your community, do we need to, Di and Teresa, in fundraising, teach our organizations how to do what I learned in college, and that is incorporate a new customer group, if you will, call them a customer, but that donor, do we need to learn to incorporate them into what it is we're already doing, rather than feeling like we have to create these other places to plug them in? Do you follow my question?
Yes. And can I jump in really quick?
Yeah,
because I'm sure I'll forget it. So Lexington, Kentucky, we were host of the Breeders' Cup this year. So the big horse racing event.
Of course.
Guess what? No fans. No fans. You know, like this is normally for us a very robust. People come in and they buy art and they, you know, all kinds of things. Well, we pivoted. I hate that word, the P word, but we actually had three artists create these beautiful life-size horses, painted them, that were on display at Breeders' Cup, because it was a way for us to make some new friends virtually. So we had Breeders' Cup and Maker's Mark Bourbon and Keeneland each sponsor one of these horses, and then they were auctioned. So that was just a blessing of revenue. Plus it was, you know, national exposure for the arts, that people love seeing, you know, these horses on display. And now, you know, we have great partners with Breeders' Cup, with Maker's Mark, with Keeneland, that will be long lasting. It wasn't a one and done, because now, you know, there's a great video actually on the LexArts site that talks about, you know, the arts. Everybody has an art story. I assure you, they have something where the arts have affected them and calmed them or made life a little easier or better or something. So that was in November, you know, just a happy, that wasn't planned is what.
Right. You don't have to prop it up. What do you think, Teresa? Well, are we going to teach?
Yeah. I think what you're talking about is integrating what you're already doing, your central mission, in your case, Di, it's the arts, into bringing people closer. So you didn't have to create a gala or a golf tournament.
Nope.
You had things that were already going on in the art space that you just weave into, hey, we're going to be, let's say you can get together. You know, we're having a gallery opening or whatever it is. Please come and enjoy it. And we'll talk to you there, rather than let's have a sit down dinner and do a PowerPoint display and show you some art and all of that. It's very artificial. Yes, Jason, I do teach major gifts. And last spring specifically, there was a student who called me offline and he said, I have always wanted to learn major gifts. I work for a nonprofit. You guys would both recognize it's a national one with three letters. And we don't have any donors. We have golf tournaments and we have galas and we have walks, but I don't have any individual relationships that you're talking about that I should be, you know, reaching out to people like you did by phone. Right. And he told me a story of one of his golf tournaments that one of the corporate representatives said, oh, this three letter nonprofit that he was there to golf for and raise money for. He said, you know, we really like, and he used two letters that were not the three letters. And he said, you know, we really like such and such, but next year we might go with, you know, X, Y, and Z. And he didn't even know why he was there. Mm-hmm. And that, and I pointed that out to him, and he, you know, he obviously understood that as a total disconnect. When you are, as Jason calls it, you know, removing the direct connection to fundraising by intervening with some golf tournament, unless you're raising money for golf, golf has nothing to do with your mission, then you are just fundraising at a distance. And if you're not, it can be a way to get people through the door or through the gate, so to speak. But if you are not following up and actually connecting them to your direct mission, then you're missing an opportunity. Right. And I love what you're doing, Di. I think you're thinking creatively because you're in a creative space, but you're also thinking about your donors, right?
Yes. We everybody uses the word donor-centric. We use people-centric. Like everything we do is about the people, whether it's, you know, big sponsors. But I don't know what both your feelings are, but in the midst of a campaign, so we're raising money, you know, for the Fund for the Arts. We also did an emergency fund. We called it the Artist Resilience Initiative. This was, you know, just, we need about $150,000 just to have these artists, be able to buy groceries. You know, it was truly an emergency fund. One of our favorite groups, band, a little three-person band, they had 71 gigs canceled. So no weddings, you know, they're not playing anything. And like, you know, that's pretty sad that there was nothing that we could do. So beyond raising our 1.1 million for the campaign, we did this emergency fund and people responded. It was wonderful. We did all that. And it was like, people were still saying, you know, what else can we do? What do you need? But at the end of the day, nobody said, oh gosh, I really missed that gala. I really missed that golf tournament. Right. I really missed they. That's what that it was like validation from a major gifts person that it's these events, you know, and even the small arts organizations found these fundraisers. There was ways to do creative virtual fundraising fun that involved families. And, you know, Teresa and I were talking about this before you jumped on, but I don't know if we're going to get people back wearing suits and ties and shoes and, you know, everything now, the culture.
No gala clothes.
I don't think that's going to mean as much anymore. I think it's almost like, you know.
Almost an affront. We'll
see. But maybe.
Spend money on gala clothes versus give your money directly to the charity.
I have totally not thought about this, Di, but this is totally where I think there's always aha moments that come out of these conversations. So I've been working on this writing project and I've been thinking about sort of the way that the early 20th century, sort of the Industrial Revolution, when we manufactured everything, has sort of affected. I have thought numerous times, and this is in the writing, that fundraising has been sort of that last emerging profession that has been affected by that particular era in history. And if you think about what you're saying, what you're both saying, is that we have manufactured these meaningful engagements that are not really meaningful engagements. We've certainly manufactured them. We've certainly created them. But it ought to be the organizations like you're working with, Di, that ought to be able to tell the sector, which is the delight that I have by putting you here on the podcast and broadcasting this to the entire fundraising community. Look, let's, and I think this is the point you're both getting at, let's stop, quote unquote, manufacturing these engagements and utilize the, they're going to gravitate back towards whatever, you know, they might show up in jeans and boots and a sweatshirt, but they're, and they're still going to want to come back because we all still want that sort of cultural center of our life. They're still going to show up at your arts center. They're just not going to want this. One of the concepts, and to your point about the centricity stuff, I think this centricity effect, as I call it, has a consequence in it, and that is it centers our attention on something. In this case, it typically centers our attention on the donor, when in fact the donor usually doesn't want it all centered on them. What you just described is 70, was it 70? I think you said 70 artists whose lives have been dramatically impacted by this. Those people are creating the art in whatever shape or form that your constituents, your donors appreciate, and your donors wanted to respond and put, and for the time being, put them at the center of their thinking. And it makes me think, and I've never put the two words together, but as I was listening to you, Di, in some ways, centering anyone is somewhat narcissistic in a sense for whoever ends up in that center. And it's marginalizing and ignoring somebody, whoever happens to be out of that. And it would seem like nonprofit organizations should be the best at not putting somebody in the center. Because when we come together, we don't really want to make it all about, I sure as hell don't want to make it all about me. You don't want to make it all about you. I don't think your rich donors want to make it all about them. And in all honesty, I don't think that artist who, even that struggling artist, who's really appreciating that gig that you've given him or her, I don't think they really want it to be all about them either. Am I right?
I think you're definitely right. I would tell one other story. So I've been with LuxArts 3.5 years. We had a nice family foundation. I make an introduction to us through a board member, and they made $1,000 gift, which is, you know, a nice first gift. And we just kind of struck up a commonality, a friendship, you know, like, I really like what LuxArts is doing. You know, they're watching. Yeah. What they don't want a coffee mug. They don't want junk. They don't want all that.
They don't want anything manufactured. Right.
They don't want that.
Yeah.
So the next year we have this group, we call them pace setters. It's an homage to the horse racing, but you set the pace, you get out there, you make your gift early, you know.
Yeah.
Really nice commitment. So we have a bunch of those. So they said, yeah, we can do that. So that was 3 years ago. Then, and they're all about face-to-face, like, you know, come see me. We want to know what's going on in the arts. Yeah. We want to hear it from your lips. We don't want to read it. We want to hear it from your lips.
Right.
So I visited them. And before I could even ask, they were like, we want to double our gift. So now they've gone 1,000, 5,000, 10,000. That was last year. So we also, in Kentucky in December, had what we call, it was like a week of giving. Like, you know, all nonprofits could participate. It was, you know, it's not something we had ever participated in. You know, those are, you know, sometimes difficult. Well, it went off the charts. We raised like 3 times what we had hoped for. We had a lot of new young donors, you know, at every level. So I went back to this family after that. We raised $30,700, you know, in a couple days. And I said, you know, people responded. This was the first week of December. Bold times called for bold actions. I'm going to ask you today, right here,
yeah,
if you would double that gift, if, yeah, you would turn that $30,000 into $60,000.
Yeah.
Without a blink, they were like, we were just waiting for you to ask, you know, like, literally, like,
of course
they were testing us, you know. I came back to the office and I was just shaking my head, like with my mask on, going, okay, that's amazing. Well, they did something else. They were like, and in addition to that $30,000 gift, because you put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah.
You are like refreshing. We're going to do our $20,000. We're taking our $10,000 pace that are making it 20. So now we're up to a $50,000 gift. But we're going to make that annual. Just we're budgeting it. Just you're in our budget. That is another bold idea, is not to be afraid to ask for reoccurring gifts. Some of these foundations and families, they can do it. And, you know, now I know I can count on that long after Di's gone.
Is it what you did? What you did in that moment. So Teresa knows this. Teresa knows this, because Teresa's family, as well as my family, we're big baseball people. Teresa's son plays baseball, and my family will spend, as soon as baseball gets back on the calendar, we'll be at the local ballpark all summer. None of us actually play baseball. We just love it's almost like a sanctuary. But if my baseball park called me right now and they said, will you pay? And I had already paid for my season tickets and didn't get to go. But if they actually called me right now and said, in order to make us sort of financially viable, in order to sort of continue to recover from this, will you pay your, not only will you maybe even forego last year's season, right? Or will you pay in advance for the subsequent season or something? I sure as hell would say yes. And it's because it's tapping into the same sort of part of our humanity that is not about being a consumer. It's about being generous, and it's about finding something that's of value to us, because the appreciation that my family has for baseball is the same that a lot of people have for the arts. And a lot of those checks, I would bet that organizations like yours are receiving, are less about having missed that experience of going to the, you know, the the performance, or the, you know, whatever the you know, the show, the art show, whatever it is they missed. But it's more so sort of being able to sort of ensure that creativity, that experience, whatever it is that their family enjoyed and counts on, is going to be there in the future. And there's not an immediate, the other thing I've been studying up on consumer sciences. When you think about consumers expect a deliverable right away. That person you're describing, Di, was not behaving like a consumer. You didn't exchange anything. You didn't put anything in your hand. I mean, granted, you assured them that you would be back, that the season would come back, you know, next year. But you didn't put a widget in their hand. No. You didn't sell them anything. No. Perhaps you assured them of a value that they would have in the future, but they were not behaving like consumers. What do you think, Teresa?
Wow, what can I add to that?
I'm just riffing. Don't.
Yeah, yeah. Drifting or riffing?
Riffing.
I have a cool baseball story, though. Don't let me forget to tell you.
All right, so
we have a small baseball stadium in Lexington. The Lexington Legends. I'm going to give them a plug. And we love baseball as well, and the community loves it. We're like, what if we brought the Philharmonic to the baseball stadium, like full on, and we did a Harry Potter, like something that would be
right.
The music, the players, people that normally wouldn't probably not go to the Lexington Philharmonic. And let's have Harry Potter at the ballpark. People are still talking about that, because there was a way to introduce baseball, kids, families, generations, yeah. And had kind of turned on a whole new group of people to, you know, the Philharmonic. Like, I didn't know that they could play Harry Potter music, yeah. And cool music. And
Teresa, is there something else happening there that Di is describing? What do you think?
Well, it's reshaping something, as she just described, that people wouldn't normally think that they would connect to. But what you were talking about before was connecting to people's humanity.
Yeah.
And I think we've all witnessed children seeing, I used to take my kids when they were little to plays, because I love plays.
Yeah.
And I took them to an opera. A friend, my assistant at MIT was an opera singer and the president of the local volunteer opera company. And, she, you know, I bought tickets and brought my little kids. And there were no kids there. And people were like, oh, they're going to fall asleep. No. They were they didn't know it was in Italian. They didn't know what they were saying. But the sets and the lights mm-hmm. and just the action, they were mesmerized by it, you know? And who would think? I think visual arts and music and all of that, it does something to your soul. My one of my most recent clients that I actually went and worked there right before the pandemic hit was the Boston Youth Symphony Orchestras. And that's about teaching, you know, young children to play instruments that lead to them, you know, playing in symphonies and so forth. And I got to witness that whole community, and it opened my eyes to a whole different way of thinking about music. It's like, who, what kindergartner would want to listen to or play symphonic music? Well, guess what they do? Because it does something to them. It rearranges their molecules is what I learned.
They say that kids, you know, are better students. They're, you know, just more empathy, more compassion, just in general. And
when I worked at MIT, MIT math mind goes with music. So that was another place that I saw. It's a hidden gem at MIT, the arts. But it added so much from sculpture to architecture to music and performances. You can't imagine what goes on there. It's wonderful.
So going back to our campaign this year, we have some, you know, pretty strong leadership community-wide, you know, heading the campaign. It's always been volunteer-driven. But you add, Bob Quick, who's the CEO of Commerce Lexington, our, you know, Chamber of Commerce, leading the campaign. His wife's an artist. He will tell you, people don't want to come to communities to visit or to live or to work or to dine or to do anything if there's not a very rich, vital arts culture. And So in addition to all the other things that we do, like the public art, the murals, and, you know, people, it was such a way to express creativity when it was pretty tumultuous. You know, every community saw a lot of, you know, the protesting and, you know, different things happening, that the arts were a great way to calm both sides of the issues. And we had a lot of new murals pop up. In fact, just yesterday, we had a local artist. He painted the Bernie sitting in his lawn chair with his mittens, you know, mural on, and people are taking pictures with it. It really is fun.
It is.
That's my why. That's why I'm raising money for the arts, because, you know, every day I kind of wake up with a smile going, this is what people need. We need it now more than ever. I think that's what they're also, that's why they're willing to give, to buy a ticket to something that they can't go see virtually. And, but that leads me to the last thing I was going to say, is that we're also seeing now people are kind of spoiled that they can stream everything, you know, that they're, you know, you can watch great concerts and go to plays and stuff and stream. It'll be interesting how to get them back into the theater, you know, buying tickets and doing those things.
Well, I think that's the humanity too. I mean, one of the things that my wife and I understand from our faith tradition, so we're Episcopalians, and we understand that, you know, there's always the music, and there's always the priest will get up there and give you a message and all that sort of stuff. But it's the Eucharist. It's taking communion, for example, the actual tangible stuff that you touch and feel and consume at the end of the process that ultimately sort of is what can only happen. I can't do that virtually. And so that part of our faith tradition is sort of what brings us back. I think that's what's going to bring people back, is there's certain parts of what happens in, it's the same thing that happens. If you think about the first time I took my wife up to New York to see, we took her, this is when we first got married. We went up to New York to see Death of a Salesman and Les Mis all in the same weekend. And to have been in that room at that time, Brian Dennehy was playing the Willie Loman part and stuff. I mean, you can't see that on a film, and you can't do that virtually. Not in the way that we were able to do it then. And so I think being able to, it's the same reason people flock to those beautiful museums in New York City to see the art up close and person, you know, right up in front of them that people, you know, hundreds and hundreds centuries ago, perhaps painted. We lose our listeners at a half hour. We've already exceeded that point. But I think there's always people who hear these conversations. You've really got my thinking going. I can assure you, you've given me just more gunpowder, if you will, to drive this message home that our donors are not consumers. They're not one and the same. But if somebody's interested in reaching out to you and continuing the conversation, how would you suggest that they do that?
Oh, definitely. I have the easiest email in the world. It's di@lexarts.org. You can find us at lexarts.org. You know, just anytime. We'd love to communicate. And if I'm going to give Lexington a plug. It really is a great place to come visit. Besides bourbon and horses, it just really is a beautiful place.
Yes. Di, it's been a pleasure. I'm glad you accepted our invitation. You're always welcome back.
Oh, thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Take care.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.